Okay, I'd like to talk about what are called the external structures in the parameter plane for these rational maps. I also apologize to many of you who were here last week when I talked about the internal structures. So a lot of the preliminary stuff that I'll talk about is actually a repeat from last week. This is done in collaboration with a bunch of people at Boston University, some of whom are here, Paul Blanchard and Monica Moreno-Rocha. All right, rather than look at the general family z to the n plus lambda over z to the d, let me stick with a simpler case, namely z to the n plus lambda over z to the n. Most of the stuff goes through in general. And I'll always assume that n is greater than or equal to 2. Let me begin with three easy, straightforward computations that I'll use. First, there's 2n prepoles for this map. Okay, all given by minus lambda to the 1 over 2n. You can also compute this 2n critical points, now given by lambda to the 1 over 2n. But there's really only two critical values, okay, because n of these critical points map to 2 square root of lambda, and the other n map to negative 2 square root of lambda. But in fact, there's really only one critical orbit. For example, in the case where n is even, the 2 plus or minus 2 square root of lambda both map to the same thing. So after two iterations, all the critical orbits agree. When n is odd, the two critical values have orbits that are symmetric. So there's essentially only one critical orbit for this relatively high degree family. Okay, now a couple other things. There's actually 2n-fold symmetry in the dynamical plane. If you look here, this is a picture of a Julia set when n is equal to 2. Let me put up n equals 3. You better. Okay, there's a Julia set where n is equal to 3, and you see 6-fold symmetry in the dynamical plane. And similarly, you see 2-fold symmetry over here in the parameter plane, and that's what I want to talk about. If you go to the case where n equals 4, you see that there's actually 3-fold. Oops, what happened? When n equals 4, there's actually 3-fold symmetry in the dynamical plane. Finally, I'll specialize in a case where n is equal to 2. And there, if you look at the map that's the second iterate of the critical point, okay, so f squared of c lambda, okay, I'll call that map g. That actually is a very nice map. It's univalent, it's linear. It's 1/4 plus 4 lambda. Okay, that's the first fact I need. The second fact is this. For any of these maps, the critical points and the prepoles are all arranged around a certain circle. And what you can compute pretty easily is if you apply the map to that circle, this circle is actually mapped 2n to 1 onto a straight line, onto what we call a critical segment. Okay, as you run around this circle, you go through critical point, prepole, critical point, prepole, and the maps go through the critical values and the poles. Okay. Also, if you take the region that's by the sector, what we call a prepole sector, that's bounded by straight lines going through two adjacent critical points, then you can check that these critical lines are mapped 2 to 1 onto the extension of the critical segment, the critical ray. This critical line is mapped 2 to 1 to this straight line here. And now if you check, if you take the outside of this sector, that's actually mapped univalently, 1 to 1, onto one of these half planes. And then the other portion of the prepole sector, the inside here, is actually mapped 1 to 1 onto the complementary half plane. So if you're in any of these 2n prepole sectors, the map takes you univalently onto the entire complex plane except those two critical rays. Okay, and finally, the third thing I need is this. Since n is greater than or equal to 2, we actually have a basin of infinity. If you think about it, when z is large, this term here is negligible. You basically get just the map z to the n. So out near infinity, you've got an immediate basin of infinity. On the other hand, if z is near 0, then this term is negligible, and basically you've got 1 over z to the n. So there's a neighborhood of the origin that's mapped n to 1 onto the basin. Okay, now, if you take this whole neighborhood, this region and the basin may not be disjoint, but in the cases that I want to talk about, they will be. So we call this the trapdoor. It's F maps the trapdoor N to 1 onto the basin of infinity. Okay, I'll use all of those results later. I also need some to mention some earlier results. One is the so-called escape trichotomy. Okay, suppose you have the situation where the critical orbit goes to infinity. Okay, then it turns out that there's three different ways that this can happen in contrast to, say, the quadratic polynomial case. One way is the critical value may reside in the basin of infinity. Okay, if that's the case, then it's pretty easy to check. Standard arguments show that the Julia set is a Cantor set. In the immediate basin of infinity, right. The B lambda is the immediate basin of infinity. Good. For example, this happens if I choose anything, any parameter outside this locus, right. This Julia set, or that parameter, is actually a Cantor set, consists of basically six blobs, but if you magnify any of those six blobs, you see that they consist of six blobs as well. Okay, and then each of those six blobs consists of six blobs, and you've got a Cantor set. In fact, one of the critical points is right here, and you see that the critical value and the subsequent orbit goes off to infinity. And meanwhile, the immediate basin of infinity, in this case, actually joins up with the trapdoor in the middle. Okay, that's the first case. The second possibility is the critical value may not be in the basin of infinity, but it may be in the disjoint now trapdoor. If that's the case, it's a result of Kirk-McMullen that the Julia set is a Cantor set of simple closed curves, all symmetrically located, or all around the origin. Okay, for example, that's what happens in this little region in the middle that we call the McMullen domain. And if I choose a parameter in there, you see basically that we've got the basin of infinity and the trapdoor, which is surrounded by an annulus that actually contains all of the critical points. One of them is right there. And the first iterate of the critical point, the critical value, resides in the trapdoor. This annulus is flanked by a pair of annuli, and each of these are flanked by a pair of annuli, et cetera, et cetera. And what Kurt showed a number of years ago is that, in fact, the Julia set is a Cantor set of simple closed curves. The final case is, well, maybe the critical value does not lie in the basin or the trapdoor, but rather maybe the critical point takes a finite number of iterations before it enters the trapdoor and falls into the basin. Okay, in that case, the Julia set is different. It's now a Sierpinski curve. Okay, and that's actually what happens in all of these other red regions in the parameter plane. That Julia set is an example of a Sierpinski curve. I know that one of the critical points is right here, and the critical value is not in the trapdoor or the basin, but after one more iteration, it falls into the trapdoor. Okay, and so forth. All of these red holes are examples of Sierpinski holes where the Julia set is a Sierpinski curve. In this case, it takes now three iterations for the critical point to land in the basin. Okay, just to remind you, if you haven't heard of Sierpinski curves, by the way, the origins of Sierpinski curves in Julia sets go back actually to a student of John Hubbard's. I think he was the first one to find a Sierpinski curve Julia set, and I forget his name. Was it Ben Widner? Okay, all right. He certainly did find them. But the people who really analyzed them were Jack and Tom Lay, if I understand correctly. Anyway, certainly Jack is heavily involved in these Sierpinski curves. Just to remind you what a Sierpinski curve is, a Sierpinski curve is any planar set that's homeomorphic to the Sierpinski carpet. I'm sure you've all seen the Sierpinski carpet. The Sierpinski carpet is this well-known fractal here. So that Julia set is actually homeomorphic to the Sierpinski carpet. Now, there's actually two reasons why these are very important kinds of sets if you're a topologist. The first is this sort of a topological characterization of Sierpinski curves, of sets that are homeomorphic to the carpet. You give any planar set that's compact and connected, that's locally connected, and nowhere dense, and has the property that if you take any complementary domain, any pair of complementary domains, they're both bounded by simple closed curves that are pairwise disjoint. So if you give me any planar set that has those five properties, then automatically it's a Sierpinski curve. It's homeomorphic to the Sierpinski carpet. Okay, and if you think about it, with Julia sets, getting a lot of these properties is very easy, okay, depending on hyperbolicity, etc. And then the final thing that makes topologists go crazy is the fact that this is a universal plane continuum. Okay, whenever you have a Sierpinski curve, you can take any planar set that's compact and connected and one-dimensional, okay, one topological dimension, and homeomorphically manipulate it so it fits inside a Sierpinski curve. Now, for my same stupid joke that I always do, okay, most people say, well, there's not too many one-dimensional compact connected sets. Yeah, that's wrong. There's all kinds of them. Here's my favorite one-dimensional compact connected set. Okay, it contains the topologist sine curve, the Sierpinski gasket, an indecomposable continuum, the alphabet, right? Okay, some members of the audience. I won't say who they are. Okay, and so forth. So the point is, it's a universal record of all these one-dimensional sets. Okay. All right, so that means that the parameter plane breaks up into three pieces. The escape locus, okay, that's the outside region where the Julia sets a Cantor set. The McMullen domain, that's that little region right in the middle, it's unique, where you have a Cantor set of simple closed curves. And finally, everything else, and that's what we call a connectedness locus. There you can prove that the Julia set is always a connected set. Okay, good. Well, two other results that I'll need. One is the now classical result of Duhaddy and Hubbard that says if you've got the basin of attraction, you can uniformize it. Okay, you can do the exact same thing by some work of Karsten and Rude for this family of rational maps because there's only one critical orbit. So you have the external rays in both the dynamical plane and in the parameter plane, in the complement of the in the escape locus. And in fact, by Karsten and Rude's work, all rational rays actually land, just as they do in the quadratic case. And now more, by some more recent work of Pascal Ruch, that just appeared in that volume we saw earlier this morning, dedicated to Bodel, you also have internal rays. If you take any of these regions in dynamical plane, like the trapdoor or the pre-images of the trapdoor, that do not contain a critical point or eventually map to a critical point, then you can actually uniformize those as well. You can put internal rays in those simply connected regions as well. And you can do that in the Sierpinski holes in the parameter plane too. So in all of those red regions, you've actually got a uniformization of, you've got external or internal rays. Okay, now what I'd like to talk about is sort of extending that a bit, but before I do, let me just actually list a couple of actually corollaries of what I want to talk about. The first corollary is this. If you take the periodic external rays, for simplicity, let me go to the degree n equal 2 case since people understand that better. If you take the periodic external rays, so they're external rays of angle something over in the case 2 to the k minus 1, the thirds, the sevenths, the 15ths, etc., then by Karsten, all of those land on the boundary of the connectedness locus, but they do so at the cusp of a baby Mandelbrot set that has base period k. Okay, for example, the zero ray comes right in here, the one-third ray comes right in here, and that's a baby Mandelbrot set of period 2. The two-thirds ray comes right in here, again, baby Mandelbrot set of period 2. And then the one-seventh ray lands on the cusp of this Mandelbrot set, period 3. Two-sevenths comes in here, three-sevenths, etc., four-sevenths, and so forth. So all of the periodic external rays land at the cusp of a baby Mandelbrot set. And there's more to the story. The tail of these external Mandelbrot sets actually lies on the boundary of a Sierpinski hole with escape time k. That means it takes k iterations for the critical points to land in the trapdoor, not the basin of infinity. For example, this period 2 Mandelbrot set, you can actually check that the tail lies on the boundary of this Sierpinski hole, which has escape time 2. Each of these period 3 Mandelbrot sets has a tail that lies on that reaches the boundary of this set, which has escape time 3, and so forth. What's that? The Chebyshev, yeah, the point corresponding to C equals minus 2. I will talk about that. Yeah, there's much more to this story than meets the eye. Yeah, all the other tips also, of at least the external Mandelbrot sets. There's other Mandelbrot sets in here. You can't see them, but those little black points are internal Mandelbrot sets. Completely different story that I'm not going to talk about. Okay, there's one. I said I'm going to deal with the case n equals 2. That's bad, because this is the hard case to deal with. Okay, the reason is there's no McMullen domain. Okay, so 0 is sitting right in the middle of the set, and in fact, this Mandelbrot set here really has lost its tip. It's lost its tail. It's cut off. So, you know, you can't use polynomial-like maps to show that this particular one is a Mandelbrot set. That's bad. On the other hand, n equals 2 is the case that you can explain to people. So, okay, one other fact. Take not the periodic external rays, but the prefixed external rays. So in the quadratic case there, something of the form J over 2 to the K, the 1 half, 1 fourth, 1 eighth, et cetera rays, okay, they actually all land on the end point of a Cantor necklace in both the parameter plane and the dynamical plane. Okay, now a Cantor necklace is something that's homeomorphic to this set here. Start with the Cantor middle third set, say in a unit interval, and add to that wherever you removed an open interval of diameter 1 over 3 to the k, throw in an open disk of that diameter. So a disk here, a pair of disks here, 4 smaller disks, etc. The union of that of those open disks and Cantor set is what we call a Cantor necklace. Okay, and the claim is that the external rays that are prefixed land on Cantor necklaces. You can sort of see that here in the parameter plane. Right, here's the one where the 1/2 ray lands, and if you look down here, you see a Cantor necklace. Well, not quite. There's the middle piece there. The rest of the Cantor necklace is really hidden in this small area, but it's flanked by 2 escape time 3 Sierpinski holes, and each of those are flanked by 2, and each of those are flanked by 2. And the remainder is actually a Cantor set. Similarly, the 1/4 ray comes into this point here, and if you look along there, you again see a Cantor necklace. Hole in the middle, flanked by 2 holes. Each of those is flanked by 2 holes, and that's also a Cantor necklace. And this Cantor necklace is all the way at the endpoints of these prefixed rays. I should also mention, if you take the actual endpoint of these rays, you get a very interesting Julia set called a Sierpinski gasket-like Julia set, studied by Monica Moreno-Rocha. Here's one example. Okay, no longer do you have Sierpinski curves, because if you look at the complementary domains here, they all touch each other in exactly 4 points. Okay, and it's a fact proved by Monica and several other people that as you go along these Mischer-Averts parameters that are prefixed or pre-periodic, you always have, except for symmetry, topologically distinct gasket sets. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of choices. Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna tell you exactly which choice to pick. I'm going to give you an algorithm for it. Yeah, I mean, you can go through and, yeah, that, and that's the whole point. You can go every way, and that gives you the whole roadmap of, I'm coming to that. Thank you. Okay, so just to lay out the picture, there's the picture of the case n equals 2 with periodic rays landing on Julia sets, and the prefixed rays landing at the endpoints of these Cantor necklaces. Okay, so here's what I really want to prove. I want to show you that both the dynamical planes and the parameter planes break into two pieces, a nice piece and a nasty piece. Okay, the nice piece is the Sierpinski region, okay, sort of these Cantor necklaces that I was talking about, where we more or less understand everything. And the nasty piece, okay, are those Mandelbrot regions, where you have such horrible things as positive measured Julia sets, non-locally connected Julia sets, squash those to points. Okay, so there's actually two pieces to this parameter plane. Okay, what I'd like to do is show you how we can use this to sort of get around the nasty piece. We can understand everything in dynamical and parameter planes using the nice pieces. Okay, here's the result, basically an algorithm. What you can do is extend those external rays that are prefixed, and extend the prefixed external rays to internal rays that snake their way through both the dynamical and the parameter plane, sort of play the role of the boundary, the puzzle pieces. Okay, they actually run through these Cantor necklaces. Okay, so you think of these Cantor necklaces as the analog of what are called bubble rays. Okay, and they give you basically a roadmap of parameter and dynamical planes. Okay, so we get a complete dynamical partition of the parameter plane into sort of internal wakes. And what I'll show you is, and I'll go through this, well, not in detail because it's a mess, but here's sort of the beginning of the picture. If I take the prefixed rays, like the 1/2 ray, the 1/4 ray, and the 3/4 ray, then there's a well-defined Cantor necklace. There's infinitely many of them, but there's one well-defined Cantor necklace that if I run down the middle of it, I get the corresponding internal ray. For example, the 1/2 ray comes right down here. The 1/4 ray runs through this Cantor necklace and lands there. The problem here is subsequent waves now break into little pieces. For example, the 3/8 ray comes down and through this Cantor necklace lands there and then jumps to continue its journey over here. Okay, the 1/8 ray in red comes down like so, then breaks and resumes its journey there. And then if you go to the 16th rays, there's four pieces and so forth. Nonetheless, these rays give you a nice, well-defined partition of the dynamical plane. No. Yes. Where is that? This one here? Period two. That's the 2/3 ray coming in there. The 1/2, this one here? Yeah. Yeah, I was going to talk about that later. There's a 1/4 that lands with this halo. So every one of these prefixed Misharevich points on the tips of the antennas have a little Sierpinski hole attached. And you can decide what they are by this algorithm of constructing the internal rays. Okay? So, to define this a little bit more precisely, I've got to define what we call the J skeleton in the dynamical plane. Okay, the J skeleton will be, take all the internal rays, okay, of the form, say, J over 2 to the K, for K up to less than or equal to J, so the 1/2, the 4th, the 8th, etc., up to some value of K, and together with that, throw in one of the equipotential curves, okay, in the basin of infinity, okay, and join these up. So that means I'll have to add a little piece of the external ray at angle 0, 1/4, 1/2, etc. So that's the two skeleton in the dynamical plane, equipotential curve and its preimage, and the rays, the internal rays, up to angle 1 over 2 to the 2. Okay, and now there's an analogous skeleton in the p-plane, in the parameter plane. Okay, the J skeleton in the parameter plane is essentially the same. Take all the prefixed internal rays and link them up with an equipotential curve. Okay, and it's several of its pre-images. Okay, I'll explain this a little bit more in detail. One slight problem is the zero ray is not prefixed, it's fixed, so I'll include that. That's the core of that baby Mandelbrot set, of this one right here, the spine of that baby Mandelbrot set. Okay, and what I want to do is give you an algorithm for constructing these skeletons in both the parameter and the dynamical plane. And that's going to get combinatorially a little bit complicated. But basically, here's the inductive algorithm. What I'll do is start with the zero skeleton in parameter plane. Okay, let me assume that then that lambda is not in the zero skeleton. I'll think about that in a minute. Okay, then that determines for that lambda the one and two skeletons in the dynamical plane. Okay, and it also determines the first digit of the critical itinerary. I'm going to attach an itinerary to each critical orbit. Okay, so once you've got D1 and D2 and the first digit in the critical itinerary, then you can go back to parameter plane and paint the picture of one skeleton. Okay, it turns out that the one skeleton divides your parameter plane into two pieces. Okay, in each piece, then, you can continue. In each piece, you get a different skeleton. You can define the three skeletons in dynamical plane. And you can go forward and get the second digit in the critical itinerary, and so forth. Once you have these two pieces of information, that gives you the two skeleton in the parameter plane. And once you have the two skeleton in the parameter plane, you can get the four skeleton in dynamical plane and digit 3 of the critical itinerary. So let me just show you what I thought I'd do is just show you how to at least begin this construction. Before I do, though, there's one other fact that is interesting. If you take any parameter value that lands in the K skeleton, okay, by this I mean the internal ray part of the K skeleton, then the Julia set is also a Sierpinski curve. So if I take any parameter along this one-half internal ray here, the Julia set is a Sierpinski curve. Yes, we know that in the Sierpinski holes, but it's also true along the Cantor set portion of this ray. Similarly here, along this internal ray, any Julia set that I yank from there is a Sierpinski curve. So they're all homeomorphic. All those Sierpinski curves are homeomorphic sets. But if you take a lambda value from different components of this Cantor necklace, maybe different Sierpinski holes, or maybe one from a Sierpinski hole and one from the Cantor set portion of the necklace, then very often, we don't know always, very often the corresponding dynamics are different. You get non-conjugate dynamics. So all the Julia sets are the same, but dynamically they change quite often. Okay, I meant to, all of these except the ones at the endpoints. All of them except the ones at the endpoints of the Sierpinski curves. Those are the ones that are either hybrid Sierpinski curves or Sierpinski gasket-like sets. Yeah, sorry, not all of them. Good. No, they change. Right? At when you go through these intersection points, some of the bubbles will come together and kiss and change. Yeah, so those are the changing points. For the critical orbit is non-recurrent, okay, and there's no parabolics, okay, and then you can show that the complementary domains have simple closed curve boundaries that are disjoint. Okay, so that critical orbit is by no means recurrent. Okay, and then the final fact is you can check that if I take all of these, the K-skeleton, the union of all the K-skeletons in the dynamical plane, they actually pass through all of these Sierpinski holes. Okay, so every Sierpinski hole is met by some of these internal rays. Okay, so let me just show you quickly how to start this. I need to define the zero skeleton in parameter plane and then show you how to generate the one and two skeleton in dynamical plane in the first digit in the critical itinerary. So, by definition, here's P0. Just take the core of the spine of that Mandelbrot set. Okay, well, sort of Mandelbrot set. It goes all the way down to zero. Okay, and then add a little bit of the zero external ray and some very close-in equipotential curve. So this is my zero skeleton in parameter plane. Now, if I choose a lambda that's not in the zero skeleton, so a lambda in any region here, what you can check is, well, the critical point and the critical value are no longer on the real line, on R plus. Okay, the critical point moves a little bit, if you remember that pre-pole sector picture I had. So, if lambda is not, if your parameter is not in the in P0, then here's how you generate the one and two skeleton. Let me draw those critical rays, lines through the four critical points. Since lambda is not real, okay, the image of this critical point is not on that same line. Right? This critical point is lambda to the 1/4. The critical value is the 2 square root of lambda, so it's up a little bit. Let me add to this picture an equipotential curve outside and a corresponding one inside, maybe in the trapdoor, maybe in the canthuset locus, whatever. Okay, let me choose two of these sectors that do not contain either of the critical values. So this is, it looks like a little bow tie. Now, what does the map do to this bow tie? Well, we know the equipotential circle. This is a quarter of a circle out in the basin, so that's mapped to a half circle. Similarly, the interior circle is mapped to a half circle. And we saw earlier that this critical line is mapped to the critical ray. So the image of this piece of the bow tie is, if I run along that blue line, I map 2:1 onto the critical ray. If I run along this equipotential curve, I'm doubled. I'm mapped by z squared onto a half circle. Run along this guy, go in and out on the critical ray. And then on this equipotential curve, I'm mapped to the other piece of the equipotential circle, the equipotential curve. So this piece of the bow tie is mapped, in fact, univalently onto basically this entire disk minus those two rays. In particular, this little region here is mapped univalently over the region I0 and the region I1. And by symmetry, same thing happens here. So we've got two disks, each of which is mapped univalently over each other. So that says that inside those two disks, we have a Cantor set. Okay, there's an invariant Cantor set in I0 and I1. Okay, and now you can check that the beta fixed point, the fixed point that lies in the boundary of the basin of infinity, actually is in I0 here. So the external ray of angle 0 actually lands on that beta fixed point. So this gives the beginning of the P structure of this Cantor necklace. Is going to be the Cantor set locus of the Cantor necklace. Okay, now let me put in the beads. Okay, if lambda is in the connectedness locus and not in P0, let me add in the trapdoor to this picture. Well, remember, we've got the zero ray landing on the beta fixed point. 1/2 lands on minus beta. So there's two points in this Cantor set that are mapped to minus beta, and they lie on the boundary of the trapdoor. So throw in the trapdoor. This piece of the bow tie is mapped over the trapdoor, so there's a preimage of the trapdoor in there, preimage of a trapdoor in here, etc. So in fact, between and the gaps of this canter set, you've got all these little open disks that are preimages of the trapdoor. So what you get is an invariant, in quotes, canter necklace. Okay, the black portion, the canter set portion, is invariant. The red portion, the beads, eventually land on the trapdoor and then go away. But that's our construction of the canter necklace. And now to get the internal rays, what I use is, well, by Pascal, this disk is mapped 2-to-1 onto the exterior region. So in fact, there's a little arc that's mapped 2-to-1 onto the 1/2 ray. Pull it back. That connects the two endpoints in the canter set to this disk. Then this region is mapped 1-to-1 here. Pull back this green region here. What we get is a curve, in fact, an invariant curve in the sense of the quotes, that threads its way right through the canter necklace. So this gives the 0 internal ray and the 1/2 internal ray. Okay. And now to get, that's D1 actually, now to get the 2 skeleton, I just take pre-images of that picture. We've got this canter necklace, this sort of quote-unquote invariant canter necklace, and the 0 and 1/2 rays running through that way, take its pre-image. Okay, by fourfold symmetry, the pre-image of this is just multiplied by I, just rotate by I. So we get, in fact, 4 canter necklaces, all of which come down to that, to the trap door. This is the 1/4 internal ray, and this is the 3/4 internal ray. And to actually make the 2 skeleton, what I do is sort of extend this a little bit. Okay, I take an equipotential curve further out, and then shoot the 0 external ray, the 1/4 external ray, out to it. Okay, now this divides the dynamical plane into 4 regions: C0, C1, C2, C3. And if you remember, the critical points were on the boundary of the bow tie, and they were mapped outside the bow tie. So these critical points all lie outside these canter necklaces, so they lie in the interior of the CJ. That gives me the first digit in the critical itinerary, right? I'll call this critical point 0, this critical point 1, first digit here is 2 and 3 and so forth. So there's the initial construction. We've got T0, 0 skeleton parameter plane. We've got D2, the 2 skeleton in dynamical plane, and the first digits of the critical itineraries. So now let me show you how to pull this back to get the remaining skeletons. Let me show you just P1, for example. Okay, for that, remember the second iterate of the critical point, this function G, is actually a nice 1-to-1 function. It's 1/4 plus 4 lambda. Okay? Notice also the G takes us from the parameter plane and puts us into the dynamical plane. It allows us to go from parameter plane to dynamical plane. So to create the skeletons in parameter plane, okay, let me just give you the easiest argument. Let's forget about equipotential curves here. Let's just take a half disk of, say, radius 1 in parameter plane. This is the lambda plane. G takes that half disk and magnifies it by a factor of 4 and translates it by 1/4. So G maps this disk onto a much larger half disk. Now, what you can check is that as long as lambda is not in the 0 skeleton, then the left piece of that bow tie is always contained in this big green half disk. Okay, so the left piece of the bow tie, what I called I1, is just varying for different lambdas, but always inside this green region. And inside that, we've got the left half of the canter necklace. So what we can do is pick any point in the canter necklace, maybe an endpoint, maybe some point in one of the Sierpinski, in one of the preimages of the trap doors, whatever. Take a particular point, call it Z star. Okay, for each lambda, you've got such a point. So we've got Z star of lambda, a function of lambda that identifies that point for the particular lambda in that's not in T0. Now, this point depends analytically on lambda. If you're in a Cantor set, it moves analytically with lambda. If you're in the, these open disks, depends analytically on lambda by Pascal Roche. Okay. So we now have two ways to going over here. We've got G, the second iterative critical point, and we've got Z star. So what we can do is go over by Z star and then come back by G inverse. Okay, and since this is Z star is always contained in a compact region of the image, right, that when you go over by Z star and back by G inverse, you're contained in a compact piece of the parameter plane over here. So by the Schwarz lemma, there's a unique fixed point for that particular map. That means there's a unique lambda value such that the second iterative of the critical point lands on the point you've identified as Z star of lambda. And so now if you do this for every different possible point in this Cantor necklace, you get the same picture over here in parameter plane. You get a piece of a Cantor necklace. Okay, so that defines the actually a piece that actually defines, I only did the left portion, the one half internal ray in the parameter plane. The zero internal ray is a little bit different. You got to use the square root of lambda. It comes down to zero, goddamn zero. It just drives you crazy. If there were a McMullen domain, you could prove it easily, but there isn't. Okay, so in any event, we get the internal ray in the parameter plane this way. Okay, and what you can actually show is, as you see in the pictures, the internal ray actually lands right along the negative real axis, right? The internal ray, okay, that I've just painted is right along the negative real axis. You can actually see that by real dynamics. Okay. All right, so now we're effectively done. We've got P1. P1 is the one skeleton in parameter plane. It's this spine of the Mandelbrot set and this Cantor necklace divides the parameter plane into two regions. The top one I'll call 0, 0. The bottom one I'll call 0, 1. Okay. And this now determines the next digit in the critical itinerary. Remember, our critical points are located here. What you can check is if I'm in the top region of the parameter plane, then right about here, the critical value doesn't move very far. It stays in the region 0. So in this region here, this 0 critical point maps to the 0 region. So I'll have its itinerary 0, 0. And then by symmetry, it turns out that the 1 critical point maps to its negative, so its itinerary is 1, 2, etc. In any event, depending on which region you're in the one in the complement of the one skeleton, you get a different behavior. You can identify what's happening to the critical orbit. Down below, you're in the region 0, 1. Now this critical point maps over here. Okay. If you're in between and over on this piece, that's where the critical point, the zero critical point doesn't stay in zero, doesn't go into one, rather it lands on the 1/4 ray, and so its next image, namely G of lambda, is on the 1/2 ray, or the zero ray. Okay, so that means we're in the internal ray already. Okay, and so finally, to get the next step in the dynamical plane to get D3, we just pull everything back, depending on whether you're in 0, 0 region or 0, 1. For it's easy to check that each of these regions, CJ, is mapped exactly 2 to 1 to a pair of the other Cs. Okay, for example, C0 is mapped 2 to 1 onto C0 union C1. Okay, and that's kind of easy to see because this portion of the boundary between a 0 and 1/4 ray is mapped to something between the 0 and 1/2 ray. Inside, you map like 1 over z squared onto the exact same equipotential curve. Now we just showed that this portion of the Cantor necklace is mapped 2 to 1, is mapped 1 to 1 onto the whole region here, whereas the 1/4 ray is also mapped like that. So the image of C0, this quarter region, is actually this half region here, and it's mapped 2 to 1 is a critical point in there. So now all we do is assume that lambda is not in P1, okay, assume that lambda is not in P1, and then the three skeleton in the Julia set in the dynamical plane is determined. If we're not in P1, if we're, say, above in 0, 0, we know the critical point has itinerary 0, 0, so it's mapped into C0. That means that there's a region, this region here, that's mapped 2 to 1 onto all of C0. Okay? Then there's also points that map onto C1, but they're mapped univalently. So there's another region, this top region here that's mapped onto C1, and this bottom region here, you can check, is mapped onto C1. So at each stage, knowing where you are in the parameter plane skeleton, or off the parameter plane skeleton, determines the topology of the corresponding skeleton in dynamical plane. Okay, and now by symmetry, you can just rotate this picture by 1/4 to get the pictures in C1, C2, and C3. And this now gives us our internal rays in dynamical plane. The 1/8 ray lands right here, is mapped to the 1/4 ray, so this curve here is mapped to the 1/4 ray, and similarly, this curve here is mapped to the 1/4 ray. So you see that the 1/8 ray breaks up into two pieces. 3/8 ray comes in, and then resumes up here, and so forth. It's a combinatorial mess, but basically you get the corresponding picture. Okay, if you're on the one skeleton, that's where the critical point maps into the Cantor necklace, onto the internal ray. Okay, and so those two regions that I drew before actually come together and kiss at the critical point. In this case, so when you're in the skeleton, the Julia set breaks up into a bunch of pieces. Okay. Each of which are mapped univalently onto some larger pieces. So you can do a symbolic dynamics. You can do the symbolic dynamics on the Julia set, especially when it's a Sierpinski curve. Okay. And finally, as lambda goes around the boundary of some region in P1, if you go around some region, the boundary of the skeleton in P1, then you can check that G of lambda actually goes around the corresponding boundary in the skeleton D2. Okay, it's kind of a false picture. For each lambda here, we get a different Julia set, so we get a different skeleton. But for each lambda on the boundary, say in Cantor set necklace part, your G of lambda actually lands in the Cantor necklace. Okay. So that means the G of lambda maps this region here univalently over a portion that looks like that in dynamical plane. So the same argument I used before says that there's a unique lambda that lands on this 1/4 Cantor necklace. So you can pull back the 1/4 Cantor necklace to parameter plane using G, just as we did over here. Long story, combinatorially a mess, but whatever. So that gives you the 1/4 internal ray, the 1/4 Cantor necklace. Down below you get the 3/4 Cantor necklace, and then continue in that fashion, and you get the 1/8, 3/8, etc. Cantor necklaces. So it's the same thing, as Adrienne says, harvest, plant in the dynamical plane, and harvest in the parameter plane. Am I out of time, or 1 more minute? A couple of minutes, okay. I did the case n equals 2. When n is greater than 2, it's visually a lot more complicated. Instead of creating Cantor necklaces, you create sort of fractal snowflakes. The fractal snowflake is start with a disk, put two disks on top of it, two disks below it, and do the same. Two disks above, two disks below, two disks above, et cetera, et cetera. And arrange it so what's left in between is a Cantor set. For example, that's what happens over here in the degree 3 case. you sort of look at the parameter plane, you can sort of see a fractal snowflake right here. Go out, get two disks above and below, two disks above and below, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a sort of a fractal snowflake there. Take that initial picture and then start pulling it back. Combinatorially, very difficult, but it's the exact same proof. In fact, it's better because now we have a McMullen domain, so zero is not in the picture. Okay, and the reason for that is, I mean, if you remember the construction where I used a bow tie, now when n equals 3, your bow tie actually has two components on each side. Okay, so you take sort of six sectors, throw away the two that contain the critical values, and then these regions are mapped, same as before, over each other univalently, get a Cantor set, fill it in with the trapdoor. And one final thing mentioned earlier, if in fact all of these Mandelbrot sets, at least the external Mandelbrot sets, sort of come equipped with halos. Okay, by that I mean if you take any of the sort of the Misharevich points, the prefixed points on the at the tips of the antennas of the Mandelbrot set, then they're attached to a specific Sierpinski hole at a specific point, and you can sort of draw a map that links this ugly portion of the parameter plane, the quadratic portion, to the nice portion, the Sierpinski portion. For example, in this, in the case of the main Mandelbrot set, the 1/4 ray comes down, it hits the tip of the period 3 bulb. It goes through the period, the escape time 3 Sierpinski hole, which hits the tip of the period 4 bulb. Then go along the 1/8 ray, you'll hit the period 5 bulb, period 6 bulb, etc. So you get a collection of little internal rays, like bubble rays, sort of kind of converge into the mouth of this Mandelbrot set. And there's all kinds of other structures looked at by Monica, Rodrigo Perez, and various other people in this parameter plane. Maybe I should stop there. Good. Thanks. What would be the topology of it? I don't know. I mean, when the critical point, I don't think it's in the Sierpinski locus. Oh no, it must be. There's buried points. Yeah, there's buried points in this. Sorry. Yeah. There's buried recurrent points in this. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's bad. Yes. No. Yes. I could prove it. I just did. Yeah. Yeah, well, do it. I have enough trouble just getting through three levels of this. Never mind recurring critical points. Something? Sorry, I didn't hear. Open? Did I say open?
Often.
Okay. Well, for example, often means usually not. If, for example, take a Cantor necklace, a Sierpinski hole, take whatever, two of these. Well, do you know that this is a dynamical invariant? These Cantor necklaces that I've constructed. There are many other Dicks, for example, Cantor necklaces. I don't know that that's the case. If that were the case, they would never be conjugate. What you can show is, for example, if you take a Julia set from this hole and any other hole, this hole has escape time 2, and this hole has escape time 3. You take two Julia sets from there, they're both Sierpinski curves, but it takes the critical point longer in one of them to escape to infinity. So there's a boundary of the basin, of one of the pre-images of the basin, that's mapped 2 to 1, but it takes 3 iterations, say, to get to the boundary of the basin. And that's a dynamical invariant. So these two would have non-conjugate Julia sets. Topologically conjugate, yes. Yeah. about or even non-orientation preserving. Yeah, not topologically conjugate. On the Cantor necklace, the Cantor set part of it. Yeah, so some points are periodic. Okay, so the critical point, and others are, those I don't know. The ones that are not, I don't know that those are different. But they're certainly different from the periodic ones or the pre-periodic ones or whatever. There might be. I don't know that, though. Yeah. That's why I'm here, to finally learn about all those things, thanks to Misha and everybody. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe. Prove it. Tell me how to prove it. Sorry. Closed. I see. So, oh God. I hope not. This is too much work. You need so run around from one Sierpinski hole and come back to it.
What? Yes.
Never thought about it. I mean.
Yeah.
Interesting. Seems to me some people I know have worked on questions like that many years ago. Yeah, right. I can't even spell automorphism now, never mind. That's an interesting question. I mean, there's so much here that, you know, that we don't know.
It seems like, it looks like your bifurcation of should be locally connected depending on your commander system. Is that something that should be fairly straightforward?
At
least that's legitimately clear.
Well, that's an interesting statement that you just brought up. I mean, it's entirely possible, for example, that you can take, this is work of Monica Marina Rocha, Doug Childers, Rodrigo Perez, John Mayer, a whole bunch of people who think about this, analogous. Take one of those horrible Julia sets from that awful Mandelbrot set where the Julia set's not locally connected. Okay, now that is a quadratic piece that fits inside this Julia set. Here, I got one. Let me just pull it out. Here it is. Okay, that Julia set has a quadratic piece. Missed. That's not locally connected. What about the whole Julia set? Most people think it is locally connected. So we get rid of all that crap. All that non-locally connected Julia set by putting it inside the larger picture, which then is locally connected, we think. I mean, it's not clear. These sort of Cantor necklace rays, these bubble rays sort of connect everything up. And so then the analogous thing would possibly be, Misha's right there, would, right? Yeah, okay, so I haven't thought about the parameter plan. I just